Thank you, Gav. It's really very moving to hear two such wonderful stories. And how fortunate we are, really, can you imagine having walked through these doors in 1939 and being the only woman in AA? I think it'd be a little scary, to say the least. And for the next 5 years, remaining the only woman, or as far as we know, the only woman to come through the doors of AA, I think that's really a pretty daring, courageous, wonderful thing to do. And it's opened up a whole new world for us, of course. When I first came into the program, I had an insatiable curiosity about alcoholism. I knew that I had it, that I caught it somehow, and it wasn't going to get better. But I wanted to read about it and find out some answers if I possibly could, and that was after I came in, and I knew that the answers were here, of course, but one of the most helpful things to me was in reading Marty's book, and that was Marty Mann's Primer on Alcoholism, which was absolutely an eye-opener. It was mind-boggling for me. And I was speaking with Janet earlier, and she was saying that she didn't know where it was available in Vancouver, so we'll have to see that she gets a copy of it. But it really is just a marvelous book, and Marty has also written another one, which was also very helpful to me, and that was Marty Mann's Questions and Answers on Alcoholism. I think that really what had happened after, from 1939 to 1944, when Marty realized that there had to be some exposure for us all. There were no doctors or hospitals who were particularly interested in hearing about our plight, and a little bit of it had to be aired. And so she presented her opinions and feelings about this strongly, and they were accepted and talked about eagerly, and Bill thought it was a wonderful idea. And so she started the National Council, so that we could spread the word on alcoholism. And look what wonders it has reaped. It's just absolutely astonishing. It's with a great deal of love and admiration, affection and appreciation that I'd like you to welcome our next speaker, Marty.
Talk about crying. It's pretty hard to find my voice, even looking around this room. I can't tell you what it feels like to be a great, 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 great grandmother to so many women. Because that's what you are, all of you. You're my children, and I'm so, so proud of you. And I'm so proud of those two who shared with us today. And so thankful to you, Jackie, that you mentioned the other part of my life. Because I was one, and now we're beginning to hear it again and again, who became so involved and so caught up both with alcoholism and my fascination and curiosity about it. I read everything and there wasn't much. I think there were 3 books in existence. And with the idea that the growth of AA could be speeded up, that the people we weren't reaching in those early days were women. And I didn't think it was because women were different from men, not in their alcoholism. And I still don't think they are. It's the same disease. And we have the same feelings about it, and we have the same suffering. Sometimes I think that women suffer more than men do, but I think that's ego. Because certainly I have tried to help quite a lot of men, and their suffering has been just as poignant and just as hurtful to them as ours is to us. Our situations are different, And sometimes that makes it seem worse, because we have been laboring under what I call a double stigma. The stigma on alcoholism is bad enough, and it's still there. Don't forget that. It hasn't gone away just because we're all here. It hasn't gone away because we've proven over and over and over again that it is a disease which is treatable and from which people can recover. And there are 1.5 million of us recovered as proof. And yet, I still work in a hospital that treats alcoholics, and I'm still amazed that the ones who come in have never heard the word any more than I had back in 1939. They don't know what alcoholism is. They're absolutely smothered under the guilt of feeling that they're bad, somehow that they are less than human. And when you see what can happen to people feeling about themselves when they realize that it isn't their fault. I never in my life heard of anybody who set out to become an alcoholic. We just wanted to drink. And we had no way of knowing that we were so constituted, and I believe physically, as well as emotionally, and psychologically, and socially, that there was something different about our reaction to alcohol. And I include the men. Our bodies had an abnormal reaction to alcohol, I think, from the word go. In my early days in AA, I used to bravely talk about the 10 years of social drinking I did. Well, in a sense, it was, because I never got into any trouble. And the reason I didn't was what I now know to be one of the early symptoms of alcoholism in most alcoholics. I had hollow legs. I'm awfully glad it's right here that I'm saying this, because one of the hardest drinking towns in the whole world is called New Orleans. And I married a man from New Orleans, and I lived here, and they said I could outdrink anybody in New Orleans. A woman that knew me then was at the meeting last night and came over to speak to me. She said, "Remember, I knew you when you were still beginning your drinking." Well, I wasn't just beginning it. I started when I was 17, and I wasn't married till I was 22. So I had a good head start. But I wasn't having any trouble. I never had a hangover. I never had a blackout. I never had the shakes. And I never had rubber legs or fell down. I never got thick speech. And I didn't look drunk. And most people didn't know I was. And I didn't know I was drunk. I'd had a lot to drink, but it didn't seem to affect me very much. I also discovered right at the beginning that 2 or 3 drinks were no use to me at all. I might as well have water. It wasn't until it got up to 4 or 5 or 6 that I began to get what I was looking for, which was some effect from it. I tell kids that whenever I get a chance, because they still believe that the person that can hold their liquor well, male or female, is somebody to be looked up to and modeled themselves on and to try to achieve that same miraculous stage. Well, all it is a very early stage in alcoholism, in my mind. So if any of you are wondering what to teach your kids, don't forget to make a point of that one. If they find that they have this remarkable capacity to hold their liquor, watch out. That's the first red flag on the road to alcoholism. When we lose our guilt, when we come to really accept And I don't mean intellectually on the top of your head, but I mean right at the gut level, down here. That we are different in that sense. That we are suffering from a disease called alcoholism, which is incurable, and which can only be arrested if you never touch alcohol again. Because your body cannot take alcohol safely, ever. Then one thing I think we have to do is what, is it Janet? Janet made a point of this, and I thought it was a very important point. We have, every single one of us, and not just alcoholics, the whole world, human beings, we have what I call a built-in forgetter. Nature put it there. Or maybe God put it there for some reason. We do not remember pain very well. We have a saying about it. We say that time heals all things, and it does. It heals the acute pain of an illness or an accident or a loss or grief of any kind or terrible trouble or something dreadful that we've done. It gets dimmer and dimmer and dimmer. And if we forget that, if we don't do, oh, let me say one thing that I know many of you have heard me say this before. I've done so much talking. Everybody here has heard my story, I'm sure. Well, there isn't time to go into it all, or we'd be here next week. I have to dole it out in little pieces when I get a minute. But I think that built-in forgetter was put there primarily for women. Because if it wasn't, I don't think anyone would have a second child. And there might not be a human race. But we have to recognize that we have that. And that it's particularly active on the troubles we had with drinking. The easiest thing in the world is after a matter even of months, but certainly of years, to begin to forget just how bad it was, just what led up to our surrendering, to our giving up and saying, I'm licked, I can't beat this, I need help. And this is why I think we can never stop any of us who are alcoholics from being active and involved in AA. Most of you know I've spent a great deal of my sober life traveling. I've been all over this country and all over the world, and there was a long period of time, many years, when I gave some 350 talks a year, four or five a day often. I was going to tell everybody what they needed to know about alcoholism. I tried. Fortunately now, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who have joined the ranks of those who are doing just that. And I think maybe we're making a dent at long last. And I'm talking about the public, everybody, because that's where all those alcoholics are hiding. The ones that we haven't reached, the ones that haven't dared come through the doors of AA, the ones that will do anything but go to AA. And so we now have treatment places that will lure them in under any pretense at all. And little do they know that the conspiracy that's going on is to get them from wherever that treatment place is into AA. I know this to be a fact because that was part of my job, the National Council. And I knew most of them, and I spent time in many of them, talked to the people, staff and patients. And the only ones that have survived are the ones who have that goal. The ones who think they can do it all professionally without the aid of AA quickly go out of business. Of course, sometimes not quickly enough. But the ones that make a partner of AA and a goal of their treatment to get the patients into AA, they flourish. And more people come to them because they hear about it and they hear that they're successful and that people come out of there and they're getting well and they're getting busy and they're getting active. And that's one of the things that I do at the one where I work, is act as a kind of liaison with AA. You know, since I stopped going to my office and traveling all the time, I moved up to Connecticut permanently and have become a Connecticut resident. I was able to start a whole new AA life. I'd been going too fast and too far to get to enough meetings to suit me. I always got to one wherever I went, but usually as the star speaker, you know, and I didn't get to hear anybody else, and that's what I needed. But now I can go to AA just as another member. And the big kick I got as I walked up here was finding that two members of my home group are here today. And I'm particularly pleased because I wasn't happy about missing last night's meeting. I'll bet you weren't either. It's Friday night, the one I go to. Well, I go to more than one, but that one I never miss. And when I make a plan to go anywhere, which isn't very often, I try to get back by Friday. And last night, there I was, sitting over in that Superdome, and I didn't know that Dot and Pat were here. I didn't know anybody from my home group was here. I'm so happy. It's just as good if you get another chance and you can sort of start all over again with a new AA life and a new place in a new area and new friends. And it seems to me, after 41 years, just as fresh and just as exciting and just as alive as it did the first time. Because AA grows on you. And it grows. I don't think basically one single thing has changed. We've been very careful to try not to let anything change. If you have a good thing, you don't want to monkey with it. And we don't need to monkey with it, because it is a live, growing, spiritual force. We couldn't monkey with it if we tried. But we don't need to. What it seems to do to all of us is to set us on a road to growth. Just when you say, and I think it's in chapter 5, that we're not looking for spiritual perfection. We're looking for spiritual growth. Well, that's just what we get. And you don't get it if you don't work for it. And you don't get it if you stay away from it. And you don't get it if you don't put a lot of yourself into it all the time. And I've learned all these things, you might say, the hard way, although I haven't had any trouble. But just by seeing things happen to other people, and I think one of the things that breaks my heart is to hear somebody that I know, after 25 years of sobriety, going back to drinking. That is a real heartbreaker. And I don't think that has to happen. It certainly isn't going to happen if you keep it green. If you remember your built-in forgetter and never let it take over. And if you stay close to the place where you learned how to live, where you learned how to love, where you learned how to care, where you learned how to be. All of us found ourselves in AA. We didn't know ourselves before. We didn't know who we were, or where we'd come from, or where we were going. I think every alcoholic who's gone far enough to look for help is lost. Just as Sandy said last night, lost, really lost. And then we find our spiritual home in this fellowship. And that's something that we all seem to recognize instantly. You know, we all repeat the same things. Everybody here this morning has said them. About feeling different, about not belonging, feeling that we don't belong. I used to try to describe it to my psychiatrist pre-AA, the one who pushed me into AA, thank God, and him. He was a wonderful man, and there are an awful lot of his patients in AA. All, not just all over the East, all over the country. His name was Harry Tebow. And I was his guinea pig. He couldn't believe it when he saw what had happened. Because I had the original word in the 12th step, spiritual experience. We changed it to awakening because the kind of being windblown on a mountaintop that Bill had and sitting in a room with a presence that enabled me to walk out of a third-story window and not fall, which I had, and a variety of them. You'll find quite a lot of them described in a little book called Came to Believe that's worth reading. I don't know if that's AA literature or not. It is. I get it from all sides and all sources. If I could find anything in it, I don't care where it came from, as long as I've got it. Anyway, Tebow didn't believe it, and so he kept me there for 6 months after it happened, and all my AA friends in New York, all 24 of them. That's all there were. All kept saying, well, what are you doing up there? You know, you're in AA now. You don't have to stay up there anymore. Get out of that hospital. But he would let me go. And since it seemed to be sticking, and it didn't pass, go away in a couple of months, and I didn't revert to my old thinking and my old ways, and clearly a change had occurred which was permanent, a 180-degree change from no faith whatsoever, in fact, an almost antagonistic attitude toward God. I guess I wanted to be an atheist, really. That was the intellectual thing to be. And I was an intellectual, of course. How I came to believe, I don't know, but it happened. And I was lucky I've never lost it. And it's propelled me. It's propelled me whether I wanted to move or not, whether I felt that the pains of growth, and there are a lot of pains in growing, there are lots of ups and downs, and there are many of us that that also have problems with depression. And that's a very difficult period. It's very hard to get through a depression and hold your faith intact and your belief that there really is a light at the end of that tunnel. And this is something that many alcoholics share. But it helps us when we talk about it together with each other. We can help each other a great deal in that, as we can in almost any problem. It sounds ridiculous to say, but I can't think of any problem that we can't get help for within AA. It's that broad, and it's that strong, and it's that powerful, and now it's that everywhere. I really got such a kick last night when those flags went up. Oh, I remember the very first trip that I took. I'd been sober 8 months, and something awful happened in Cleveland. They ran a series of two steps at a time in a box on the editorial page of the Cleveland Plain Dealer with a box number. And the mail arrived in bushel baskets. And there were 24 members. And we just thought the whole thing was going to blow up. You know, how are they going to handle that? What could you do with that? And so there was one car in the whole group. And Bill and Lois and Jack and his wife, the owner of the car, and I decided to go to Cleveland and see for ourselves what was happening. Save it, maybe. We didn't have any money, so we started at 4 a.m. because we couldn't afford to stay overnight anywhere. And we got there very late at night and found a house crammed with people waiting for us. We were kind of tired. So we didn't have a meeting right away. This was about 1 a.m. But we did the next night, and it was the biggest thing I'd ever seen. There were 100 people in that room. And Bill and Jack and I all spoke. And I remember saying, wouldn't it be wonderful someday if we could go all across the country, and in every big city like Cleveland, we could find an AA group. And everybody roared with laughter. Most ridiculous idea in 1939. And now look at the damn thing. I'll bet if you were in a helicopter and put down in the middle of the jungle in the middle of Africa, you'd find a loner. Maybe even a group. I just want to say again that I don't think we're any different, basically, from the men members. The same steps work for us. We use them the same way. We get the same benefits. And I don't believe the figures they give us. I think the proportion of women is higher. I go to an awful lot of closed meetings, especially in big cities or big communities, and sometimes in smaller ones too, where the women outnumber the men. And in the last few years, they've been coming in droves. And as the stigma lifts and more of us talk about it openly, freely, and show that we don't feel ashamed, and we have no cause to, we don't need to feel ashamed. We should be proud. If we could make all of those women who haven't come in yet realize that, they'll come in still bigger droves. Because it's shame and stigma that keeps them from it, in my opinion. Oh, there's a little thing called denial, too. But that's easier to overcome than the other. And that's not easy. But it can be done. And a good 12-stepper can do it. I've seen it happen over and over and over again. So just let me say to you how grateful I am that you're all here this morning and that I could be here with you and that I could stand up and see this room packed, lined up, standing at the back. And we even have quite a lot of men here. Of course, they're probably just curious. They want to know what we're really going to talk about. Not very different. Not very different at all. You know, there's a big controversy brewing in the professional world about the difference in alcoholism in women and how there ought to be special treatment facilities and special things set up and special things done. I don't see it. We haven't been doing too badly the way it is, I don't think. So I don't think we'd better tamper with that either. I don't think we will in AA, but they may outside and give us some extra problems we'll have to deal with. Convincing those women they're no different from the rest of us or from their fellow AAs who happen to be male. No, truly. We have a bond in a disease. A strange way to have a bond. It is deep and strong and that flows constantly through us and passes on to anyone who will hold their hands out. And it doesn't stop flowing. And I just think we're the luckiest people in the world.
It's been an extraordinary morning and very exciting for all of us. I'd like to just, before I close, tell you very quickly, it's curious that Janet is in 4.5 years and Kiki's in 8.5 years and I'm in 12.5 years. So we're evenly spaced. That was not meant to be. It was coincidental. But when I came into the program, I belonged to a little group in New York called the Mustard Seed at that time. And we had quite a number of women members, but I was the only woman who would speak. They were all terrified, and they'd sit in the corners and in the back, and they were afraid to raise their hands, and they were afraid to share. And I must tell you that it was, I guess, a little bit of an ego trip for me, because I had an absolutely marvelous time. I went everywhere. I spoke to the U.S. Navy and colleges, and I was all over the place like apple butter. But it was great for me, but I think what it did, too, was to help them see that it was all right for them to go out and speak, and nothing terrible was going to happen, and that it was important for us to be able to share with other people, and the identification with the particular problems that perhaps we do have that are a little bit unique from time to time. Not especially too much, but a little bit. Can be shared with other people. So I urge you all, if you're not sharing in your group by going out and speaking, please do as much as you can. It really is so tremendously helpful to everyone else. I'd like to thank you all for being here, and especially our three speakers, Janet and Kiki, and of course Marty. And I think Joan would like to close the meeting for us. Thanks again.
I would just like to join in thanking our wonderful speakers for this very moving and inspiring meeting. Janet, Kiki, Jackie for chairing our meeting, and of course Marty. Thank you so much. And now, in closing, for all those who care to join in the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Jackie, that was a wonderful meeting.
It was a nice meeting. Thank you.